Part 3. Sea Launch. Chapter 37. June 16th, 2007, Long Beach, California. Though it was a cool, damp Southern California morning, Danny Stamp could feel the sweat beginning to drip from his underarms. The veteran engineer was as nervous as a teenager on prom night awaiting his first makeout session. But as those who knew him could affirm, he always felt this way when his baby was on the move. No diaper-clad infant, his baby today was a 209-foot Zenit 3SL liquid-fueled rocket that was in the delicate process of being transferred to its launch platform. The roundish and slightly balding launch vehicle director peered purposefully over the railing of a large ship superstructure as the $90 million rocket he was responsible for inched into view below his feet. As the huge white cylinder rolled slowly out of its horizontal berth on a centipede-like cradle, Stamp's eyes were drawn to the large blue letters emblazoned on the rocket's housing that read, Sea Launch. Incorporated in the 1990s, Sea Launch was an international commercial venture formed to provide rocket launch services geared primarily for satellite telecommunications operators. The American aerospace giant Boeing was the prime founder, signing on to handle launch operations as well as integrating the customer's satellite payloads into the rocket housing. Turning swords into rubles, a pair of Russian companies joined the consortium by providing the actual rockets, or launch vehicles, as they are known in the parlance. Ex-military rockets that once carried nuclear warheads, the Zenits were tried and true launch vehicles that were perfectly suited to commercial applications. But it was a Norwegian firm, Kvaerner, which provided perhaps the most unique asset to the venture. Starting with a used North Sea oil platform, the Oslo firm constructed a self-propelled floating launch pad which could be positioned for launching in almost any ocean waters of the world. Though an interesting selling point, practicality dictates that there is only one area on the globe worth launching from, and that is the equator. For a geosynchronous satellite which remains in a fixed relative orbital position following the Earth's rotation, there is no more direct path to orbit than from the equator. Less rocket fuel burned in pushing a satellite to orbit can allow for a heavier satellite payload. Satellite owners, seeking to maximize revenues from their multi-million-dollar investments, can thus add more capacity to their satellites, or additional operating fuel to extend the satellite's life. Integrating the satellites into the launch vehicle in Long Beach, then sailing the rocket to the equator for launch, had grown from an intriguing idea to an efficient business model in the high-stakes, high-risk game of commercial space operations. A handheld Motorola radio fastened to Stamp's belt suddenly crackled with static. "Rollout complete. Ready for crane hookup," barked the unseen voice. Stamp paused and studied the Zenith rocket, which protruded from the ship's stern like a stinger on a wasp. In an unusual bid for flexibility, the Sea Launch team actually assembled the rocket and its payload in the bowels of a custom-fitted ship named the Sea Launch Commander. Officially known as the Assembly and Command Ship, the 660-foot cargo design vessel contained a myriad of computer bays on its upper deck, as well as a Mission Operations Command Center, which directed the complete launch operation at sea. On the lower deck was a cavernous assembly compartment that housed the Zenit rocket components. Here, an army of white-smocked engineers and technicians bolted together horizontally the segmented Russian rocket sections, utilizing a rail system that ran nearly the length of the ship. Once the rocket assembly was complete, the mission satellite was encapsulated into the upper section payload fairing, and then the entire launch vehicle was rolled at a snail's pace out the stern of the Sea Launch Commander. "Proceed with hookup. Transfer when ready," Stamp spoke into the radio with a slight Midwestern accent. He glanced up at a huge crane system built onto the edge of the towering launch platform. A pair of tilted M-shaped trusses extended off one end of the platform, dangling several lines of thick cable. The floating platform, christened Odyssey, had been positioned just aft of the Sea Launch Commander, its crane system hanging directly above the prone rocket. The crane's winch lines were silently dropped down to the launch vehicle, where teams of engineers in hard hats attached the cables to a series of slings and lift points along the length of the rocket. "Sea Launch Commander, this is Odyssey," a new voice blared through Stamp's radio. "Ready to transfer launch vehicle." Stamp nodded to a short fellow standing beside him, a bearded man named Cristiano, who captained the Sea Launch Commander. Cristiano spoke into his own radio. "This is Commander. Proceed with transfer at will. Good luck, Odyssey." Seconds later, the cable lines drew taut and the horizontal rocket was lifted slowly off its cradle. Stamp held his breath as the Zenit rocket was hoisted high into the air until it hung suspended far above the decks of the Commander. The unfueled rocket was just a fraction of its launch weight, so the process was akin to lifting an empty beer can. But Stamp couldn't help feeling nervous watching the huge rocket dangling in midair above him. After a tantalizingly slow rise to the top of the launch platform, the crane operations crew activated the movable winch, and the launch vehicle was tugged horizontally into an environmentally controlled hangar on Odyssey's high deck. Once the tip of the rocket had cleared the hangar doors, the entire launch vehicle was gently nestled down into a wheeled cradle. When the floating platform reached the designated launch site, the cradle device would roll the rocket out of its hangar and tilt it up on end for firing. "Launch vehicle secure. Well done, gentlemen. The beers are on me tonight. Odyssey out." Stamp visibly relaxed, a broad grin spreading across his face. "Piece of cake," he said to Cristiano, as if the outcome was never in doubt. "Looks like we'll make the scheduled launch date in 17 days after all," Cristiano replied as he watched the empty launch vehicle cradle slide back into the ship's lower deck hangar. "The long-range weather forecast is still looking favorable. After final checks and fueling, the Odyssey can depart in 4 days, and we'll follow in the Commander 48 hours later, after additional spares and provisions are put aboard. We'll easily catch up with her before reaching the launch site." "A good thing, too," Stamp said with relief. "There's a penalty clause in the customer contract that's a killer if we are late to launch." "Nobody could have predicted the dock workers' strike would delay receipt of the Zenit rocket components by 15 days, Cristiano said, shaking his head. "The launch vehicle team did a heck of a job making up lost schedule. I'm not looking forward to seeing the overtime charges, but the team must have set a record for assembly and integration, even with our paranoid customer shielding the mission payload from everyone." "What's so terribly secretive about a broadcast television satellite?" "Search me," Stamp said, shrugging his shoulders. "Typical Asian reticence, I guess. The whole operation doesn't make sense to me. They've got a relatively lightweight satellite that they could have easily launched off the Chinese Long March rocket for a couple of million dollars less than our fees. Angst with the Chinese isn't an unusual sentiment in the Far East." "True, but usually overlooked when it comes to dollars and cents. Perhaps it's due to the head of the telecommunications firm. He's apparently a real maverick." "He owns the company outright, doesn't he?" Cristiano asked, his eyes searching skyward, trying to recall. "Yep," Stamp replied. "Dai Zhong Kang is one rich and powerful man." Kang leaned back in the padded leather chair of his cherrywood study and listened intently as a pair of engineers from his Incheon facility provided a technical briefing. Dongju sat silently at the back of the room, his dark eyes scrutinizing the men out of habit. One of the engineers, a slight, disheveled man with glasses and a deeply receding hairline, spoke to Kang with a raspy voice. "As you know, the KoreaSat-2 satellite was delivered to the launch provider's facility approximately 3 weeks ago, where it was encapsulated inside the payload fairing, or nose cone section, of the Zenit rocket. The entire launch vehicle has since been loaded onto the self-propelled launch platform, which is preparing for departure to the equator." "There have been no security lapses?" Kang asked, throwing a cold glance towards Tongju. The engineer shook his head. "We've had our own security team protecting the satellite around the clock. The Sea Launch team suspects nothing. By all external appearances, the satellite is designated for television broadcast services. Now that the satellite is enshrouded in the rocket housing, there is little chance of suspicion. The engineer swallowed a sip of coffee from an overflowing mug, spilling a few drops of the hot liquid on the sleeve of his worn checkered sport coat. The brown stain matched a similar pattern of spots on his tie. The aerosol device. It was verified as operational, Kang asked. Yes. As you know, we made a number of modifications from the small-scale model that was tested in the Aleutian Islands. There is no longer a dual-agent capability, as the deployment of the cyanide mixture was eliminated from the mission. Plus, the system was redesigned with removable canisters that will allow us to arm the payload with the bioagent just hours before launch. And of course, it is a much higher volume system. The Aleutian test model, you may recall, carried less than 5 kilograms of biochemical compound, while the satellite vehicle will deploy 325 kilograms of the Chimera agent after hydrogenation. Before the satellite was encapsulated at the sea launch facility, we conducted a final late-night test under secure conditions. The test results were flawless. We are confident the aerosol system will operate as designed over the target. I do not expect any failures from our equipment, Kang stated. The launch operation will be the most critical phase of the mission, the raspy-voiced engineer continued. Li Wook, have we obtained the necessary command and control data to proceed with an independent launch? The second engineer, a younger, greasy-haired man with a broad nose, was clearly intimidated by Kang's presence. There are two primary components to the launch process, Li Wook replied, stuttering slightly. The first is positioning and stabilizing the floating launch platform, then erecting, fueling, and preparing the rocket for launch. We have obtained the sea launch operating procedures for these steps, he said, neglecting to mention the cash bribes involved, which our team has reviewed and practiced thoroughly. In addition, we have obtained the services of 2 Ukrainian launch specialists, formerly employed by Yuzhnoye, the manufacturer of the Zenit rocket. They are assisting with trajectory and fueling computations and will be on hand to assist with the mechanical preparations. Yes, I am aware of the enticements required to obtain them, Kang replied with distaste. I believe the Russians could teach the West a thing or two about capitalistic extortion. Li Wook ignored the comment and continued speaking, his stutter finally under control. The second critical component is the actual launch initiation and flight control. During a normal launch at sea, the sea launch assembly and command ship performs these controls. For our launch, this duty will be handled by the Bayekche. We have refitted the ship with the necessary communications equipment and computer hardware required to execute the launch and flight control, Li Wook said, his voice almost at a whisper. Our last input has been the software that monitors, tracks, and commands the launch vehicle. The actual launch from the floating platform is a highly automated process, so the software plays a critical role. There are several million lines of software code that support the launch, telemetry, and tracking phases. Have we recreated the necessary software for our mission? It would have required many months to write and test the software on our own. We were fortunate in that all of these software programs are contained within the databases of the assembly and command ship. As the payload customer, our team has had almost unlimited access to the ship for the last 3 weeks, while the KoreaSat 2 satellite was being integrated with the launch vehicle. Once on board, our systems team found it relatively easy to breach the vessel's mainframe computers and acquire the software code. Under the nose of their computer experts, we downloaded copies of the software and over a 4-day period transmitted the code by satellite link direct from the sea launch vessel to our laboratory at Incheon. But I was told the Bayekche, or Koguryo, as she is now called, left port a day ago. We have already transferred a portion of the program to the shipboard computers and will download the remaining software while the ship is in transit via satellite. And you have determined the optimal flight path to achieve maximum dispersal of the agent? Kang asked. We can theoretically launch uprange of the target as far as 4,000 kilometers away. However, the probability of accurately striking the target is quite small. There is no guidance system for the suborbital payload, so we are relying on wind, thrust, and launch positioning to reach the strike zone. Utilizing normal Pacific wind conditions, our Ukrainian engineers have determined that positioning the launch platform approximately 400 kilometers uprange of the target will maximize the accuracy of delivery. Adjusting for atmospheric conditions at the time of launch, we can expect the payload to fall to Earth within a 5-kilometer radius. But the aerosol system will be activated well before that, the first engineer injected. Correct. At an elevation of 6,000 meters, the aerosol or payload system will be activated. This will occur shortly after the nose cone fairing has been discarded during flight. In its descent, the payload system will be traveling nearly 8 kilometers downrange for every 1 kilometer of descent. A vapor trail of the armed agent will thus be dispersed along a 48-kilometer-long corridor. I would have preferred that the launch not take place so close to the North American mainland, Kang said with a wrinkled brow. But if the accuracy of the mission dictates such, then so be it. The flight trajectory will be controlled by the rocket burn. Precisely. The Zenit 3SL is a three-stage rocket, designed for pushing heavy payloads into high orbit. But our desired maximum altitude is less than 50 kilometers, so we will not fuel the second and third stages, and short-fuel the first stage. We can terminate the burn at any time, which we will program to do at slightly over a minute into the flight. As the launch vehicle coasts in flight to the east, we'll initiate separation of the payload section from the rocket boosters, then release the payload housing. The Mach satellite will deploy the aerosol system automatically and disperse the agent until impact. Are we positive the American missile defense systems pose no risk? The American anti-ballistic system is still in its infancy. It is geared towards intercontinental ballistic missiles that are launched from thousands of miles away. They will have no time to react. Even if they did, their intercept missiles would arrive after we have initiated separation. They might harmlessly destroy the rocket boosters at best. No, sir. There will be no stopping the payload deployment once we have launched. I am expecting the countdown to occur while the G8 leaders are in the target area, Kang stated bluntly. Weather permitting, we have scheduled the launch to coincide with the pre-summit assembly in Los Angeles, the engineer said nervously. I understand that you will see things through from Incheon. The telecommunications lab is in constant communications with the Koguryo and will be monitoring the launch live. We, of course, will be advising the shipboard crew during the countdown preparations. I trust that you will be able to join us in viewing the launch? Kang nodded. As my schedule permits. You have done exceptional work. Bring the mission to success, and you will bring high honor to the Central People's Committee. Kang nodded again, indicating that the briefing was over. The two engineers glanced at each other, then bowed to Kang and quietly shuffled out of the study. Tongju rose from his seat and stepped to the front of the large mahogany desk. Your assault team is in place? Kang asked his quiet enforcer. Yes, they remained aboard ship in Incheon. With your indulgence, I have arranged for a company jet to fly me to an abandoned Japanese airstrip in the Ogasawara Islands, where I will rejoin the vessel for the operation. Yes, I expect you to lead the assault phase. Kang paused for a moment. We have come a long way in implementing our plan of deception to risk failure now, he said sternly. I will hold you responsible for the continued secrecy of our operation. The two Americans. They surely drowned in the river, Tongju replied in a hushed tone, catching Kang's drift. There is little they know or could prove, even if they somehow survived. The difficulty lies in maintaining the deception once the mission succeeds. The Japanese must be painted as the responsible party, with no recourse. Once the strike is made, the only physical evidence will be aboard the Koguryo. Precisely. Which is why you must destroy the ship after the launch. Kang spoke as if he was asking for a napkin at a cocktail party. Tongju arched a brow. My assault team will be on the ship, as well as your many satellite telecommunications experts, he questioned. Regrettably, your team is expendable, and I have already ensured that my top satellite engineers are remaining in Incheon during the operation. It is the way it must be, Tongju, Kang said, showing a rare hint of empathy. It will be done. Take these coordinates, Kang said, passing an envelope across the desk. One of my freighters bound for Chile will be waiting at that position. Once the launch is initiated, have the captain sail the Koguryo to within sight of the freighter and scuttle her. Take the captain and two or three men if you wish, and make your way to the freighter. Under no condition must the Koguryo be apprehended with the crew aboard. Tongju nodded in silence, accepting the mass murder assignment without question. Good luck, Kang said, rising and escorting him to the door. Our homeland is counting on you. After he left, Kang returned to his desk and stared up at the ceiling for a long while. The wheels were in motion now. There was nothing more he could do but wait for the results. Eventually, he pulled out a file of financial reports and began methodically calculating his next quarter's expected profit.